Hey there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. We are coming to you with the what should be the first episode in March, which is pretty exciting. This is our third month and our third year of podcasting, and we are continuing to follow this new model, and I guess it's not really new when you're about 10 episodes in, and that's where we do different topics every week instead of doing what we did in our first 2 years, which were essentially seasons with a particular set of topics in mind for somewhere between 15 and 30 episodes. I know that's quite a bit. We had very long seasons. But what we're doing now is, because we've built up such a substantial catalog of episodes within these various topics, we thought, hey, why don't we go back and every month maybe recover something we need to touch back on or find things that we missed in those old seasons that we weren't able to get to and do, and then just spread them out throughout the month. That way, if somebody is tired of hearing about doctrine, they can just, they still have an apologetics episode to listen to every month, or they still have a history episode to listen to every month. And we've been trying to do Q&A episodes every month as well. So we're getting to listener questions live on the show, which is nice because as a podcast that has hosts who travel, we often have to record many shows at a time in advance. So when listeners ask us questions about a show, it could have been up to 5 weeks ago that we recorded that episode. And now that we're trying to do a Q&A more than once or twice a year, we can actually get to those questions a little closer to when people ask them and do them live on the show and kind of take those questions that we think, hey, we should really broadcast these instead of just writing an email back to the person and do those. So we'll have one of those this month in March, but we're going to start off with an episode that's somewhere between doctrine and history, or it falls into both, because we're going to talk about the formula of Concord today. And this is following in that same vein as where last month we talked about Luther's Small Catechism. We're going to do the formula of Concord today. We'll do other parts of the Lutheran confessions throughout these months as we get closer to the Reformation Day celebration again. I have things kind of spread out. We'll talk about the Augsburg Confession, probably on the anniversary of the Augsburg Confession and things like that. So, but today we're going to do the formula of Concord. We're going to do a little bit of its, Dr. Keith is good about talking about its background and kind of the story behind it. We'll talk about the main articles within it and the like. So without further ado, let's get into this episode. So the formula Concord, whenever I think about it, the first word that hops into my mind, and I think the consensus before we started the show, was the word controversy, right? Like, as you're warming up and you're thinking about the...
I thought you were going to say Concord.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, harmony or Concord, or finally there was peace.
Well, okay, as a result of,
yep.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
I guess I'm thinking of the background of it, right?
Well,
or
yes.
The response.
When you say controversy. The Concord means unity, it's sort of leading, and you might ask, so why was there a need for unity?
Yeah.
And, I mean, the simple answer is because there was quite a bit of disunity.
Yeah.
One of the things that Lutherans, I mean, I feel like you could, the question when you talk about the formula of Concord is how far back do you take the story of why we needed the formula of Concord?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you take it back to the Augsburg Confession and the Apology? Do you take it back, you know, that's 1530, 1531. So some 40 years, or 30, 45 years even, before the Formula of Concord. Do you take it back to, you know, Luther's really last the confessional writing that we have in the Book of Concord and the Small Called Articles? Do you take it back to Luther's death in 1546? I mean, how far back do you go? But one of the things I think Lutherans, after they discovered that the fight with the Roman Catholics wasn't really producing any perceivable gains, one of the things they decided is that maybe if we're going to fight, it's more productive to fight amongst ourselves.
Yeah, let's fight each other.
Well, there really were issues that did need to be ironed out within our own camp. We had some guys go off the reservation.
Yeah, pretty early, too.
Yep.
And that's why I asked these questions, because, I mean, there are many controversies that make up Lutheran history during the Reformation, say 1530 to 1580, right? There are many, many controversies. Interestingly enough, a lot of them center around things that either Philip Melanchthon said or did.
Yep.
Quite a few of them. Some of them don't. But really, they're... When I teach this to my students at the university, I'll tell them we have a tendency to look back on the Reformation, we see it as sort of this glorious time where, you know, sort of the shackles of Roman Catholic Catholics bearing down on, you know, keeping the gospel away from the people, that these shackles were broken forth and the gospel broke out, and then it went like wildfire and everything was sort of rainbows and puppy dogs after that. And the reality is that sort of the first part of that is maybe true. The gospel broke out and it spread like wildfire throughout the Holy Roman Empire. But the last part is certainly not true. It was not rainbows and puppy dogs. And what we need to understand, I think, when we think about these things, is that these characters that we love or hate, Luther, Melanchthon, Calvin, maybe even put in that, if you're talking about the Reformation generally, while they were very brave and they were very smart and they wrote many, many things that helped us along the way in getting our theology right and keeping it that way, they also were just figuring stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an entire system that had...
Under pressure.
You know, had sort of kept things, I don't want to say in order, but maybe in a sense in order for, you know, a millennia or more.
And when you start throwing things out, the question becomes how much?
Right.
And why? And then you'll find that people go very... And part of the formula is people go various degrees on what to throw out or what to include. And the controversies can include thinking you're going too far, throwing too much away, or trying to get closer back to Rome.
Right. So one of the controversies that Lutherans engage in is something called the synergistic controversy, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you all of a sudden adopt a completely monergistic view of justification, in other words, that if a sinner is justified, it's God's work from beginning, middle, and end, mm-hmm. right? Completely one-sided action mm-hmm. against sort of the Roman semi-Pelagian view or more synergistic view, you know, people start asking questions right away. I mean, if you've ever taught that to a group of people, you'll know that questions start coming up right away, and the questions usually start with, well, what about, well, mm-hmm. can I, well, when I do this, you know, does this really, does God look at this, da, da, da. All these questions come out, and the same thing happens here in the Reformation, right? All these questions come out, and you get people attempting to answer these questions, and as they attempt to answer it, other people don't like their answer, and or don't think that their answers are scriptural, and these controversies just sort of pop up.
Yeah, one of the ones I'm always referring to when people write in, if you want to know our position on predestination, don't just read Luther's The Bondage of the Will. Read it, but consider Article 11 in the formula.
Right.
That's what we subscribe to.
Right. Which is, I mean, that's a good, I don't know how deep you intend this episode to go, Caleb, but one of the interesting things about that is that it's not like The Bondage of the Will wasn't considered for entrance into the Book of Concord, because it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were many, many sort of corpus doctrinae, right?
These the actual book was?
Yeah, these
really?
Bodies of
no idea.
Gathered, collected works from various individuals were put together and were circulating around, you know, the evangelical or Lutheran lands at the time for consideration to mm-hmm. be included in what we would now call the Book of Concord. And
The catechisms, for instance, were included.
Yeah. Bondage of the Will was considered. Melanchthon's Loci Communis was considered and not put in. Melanchthon wrote other confessions that were considered and not included. And so this was a process. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it was actually a pretty long process.
Yeah.
May I ask a question? Yeah. Why wasn't the Bondage of the Will and the Loci Communis included?
On the side of the Bondage of the Will, in my opinion, what happened is that Lutheranism didn't go as hardcore monergistic mm-hmm. as Luther did in the Bondage of the Will.
Okay.
Lutheranism, I think rightly so, landed on the side of stopping where the scripture stopped
mm-hmm.
as far as what to say and what not to say.
Gotcha.
I'm not accusing of Luther of doing otherwise, but there are those accusations
out sense.
There,
yeah.
and
yeah.
Those accusations are out there today, and they were then too, and not everybody signed on to it. And so, if this is a book of unity, people were not unified behind Luther's doctrine of predestination in the Bondage of the Will.
It'd be sort of strange for a work on a particular occasion, the Bondage of the Will,
mm-hmm.
Luther responding to Erasmus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To be included in a document or a collection of books.
It would.
Yeah.
It would. And that's part format. That's part of what they saw. This would be unusual to include.
Right.
The other thing is, it's worth mentioning, our classic book on the history of this business, Bente, he includes a section on the difference between Luther's Bondage of the Will and Article 11.
He does, yeah. It's interesting, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's way deeper than our listeners want to go, but
it's an. I like that Adam, you said that Luther wrote the Bondage of the Will to an occasion, because one of the things I'll tell the master students all the time is if they're trying to figure out, say, the difference between Luther and Melanchthon and how they write, one of the ways you can distinguish the difference, I think, is by understanding that Luther, on the whole, is an occasional theologian and a pastor. Not that he just practices theology occasionally, like me, but to an occasion, right? He's asked a question, he provides an answer. He receives a letter, he writes a response.
We just talked about this when we did Theology of Cross and Glory with Heidelberg, too, where that was a particular, a meeting that he was writing for.
And it makes many of his writings, they're not confessional in a sense. They're not systematic either, or either one. Whereas on Melanchthon's side, he wrote many confessions.
He has the bigger picture.
Yeah. I mean, outside the Book of Concord, he wrote several confessions, too, that were considered for inclusion and that type of thing.
Great. Hey, so I think one of the things we can do here, and this might help, one of the problems we were discussing is how do we cover all the controversies in here? And obviously, I don't think we have time to do every controversy in here. In fact, they could probably
do
an episode on each one, right?
Yeah.
But there's 12 main theses, essentially, in the Formula of Concord. So maybe we should outline those, say what those are, and then maybe I think we'll have enough time to just say maybe a minute or two of why this one, and then there are some bigger hitting ones that we might say caused more disruption, or there was more time arguing over these, and we can probably spend some more time on that as well.
Well, I've got a list of them in front of me.
Let's go for it.
We can at least hear the list. The adiaphoristic controversy.
Are we commenting on each one or just reading them?
First of all, just let them go into the ear balls.
Do it, doctor.
The majoristic controversy. The synergistic controversy, the Flotsian, that's from Flotsius, the Flotsian controversy, the Osiandristic controversy, the antinomistic controversy, the crypto-Calvinistic controversy, the controversy over Christ's descent into hell, the predestinarian controversy. Those are the majors. If you looked at a table of contents, you'd see that.
So let's juxtapose that list to the articles in the formula, because I think even reading the top-level titles of the articles in the formula, one could discern which controversy is being addressed.
Yes.
And that's... do you want to do that, Caleb?
Yeah, so the first one is on original sin. Which makes a lot of sense, because this is one of the areas we differ with Rome, right? Especially concerning baptism.
Well, certainly, and it's that one is going to deal with ideas of synergism. Right?
Yeah, monergism versus synergism.
Because if you have a low view of original sin, you'll have a high view of your ability to either...
Invite Jesus into your heart.
Invite Jesus into your heart. That's a good way to say it.
It connects to the Flakian controversy as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's a whole discussion about whether original sin is a substantial part of...
Right. Yep. Is it our essence?
Substance or accident.
Yeah. The way it got put across was to be human is to be a sinner.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And somebody in the back of the room said, I got a problem with that.
Jesus was human.
Was that you?
And if you read Chemnitz on Two Natures of Christ, too, he spends a lot of time saying, like man and always accept sin.
Of all those conceived in the usual way, you'll say.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So then number two kind of leads off of this, and against the bondage of the will. So we have free will would be the heading for number two.
Yeah.
So concerning free will.
Yeah, which you'll find is in favor of the idea of the bondage of the will.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it gets included in a way there via his students, right, who believe in this. The next one is concerning righteousness of faith before God.
Yeah. Right. Again, many of these are dealing with the same controversies, sort of just fleshing it out through different means.
Yeah, if you follow the history of sort of Lutheranism, in during the Reformation period that we've done on the show. None of this will seem surprising to you, I don't think, if you've listened to the show before, that this kind of stuff is coming up. Controversy concerning good works. Good works is the next one.
Which makes sense, too, because not directly following the ordering of the Augsburg Confession, but not far off of it either, mm-hmm. where you have justification, the doctrine of the ministry, which is in Article 5 of the Augustana, which is really dealing with, I'm justified, how do I get it, right? And it's going to say by proclamation of the word and sacraments.
And since 1518, Luther has been defending the position that he does right. not reject good works. In fact, that's a decent chunk of the Heidelberg Disputation is saying, I'm not rejecting good works. I'm just saying you have to acknowledge that your works are sinful.
Right.
And the majoristic controversy is about good works, right? Yep, whether they're right. necessary for salvation or not.
And so too, then, if you consider in Augustana sort of 4 and 5 being connected, Article 6 is then good works. And so then here you have 4, justification 5.
Yeah, Major meant well. But he went too far. He finally was defending the thesis that good works are absolutely hostile to your salvation. Somebody in the back of the room said, I think that's too far.
I like it, but I think it's too far.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's great.
God bless those people in the back of the room.
Yeah, yeah.
So then we have Law and Gospel, which again, we've spent so many episodes talking about this and this distinction being central to the Lutheran Reformation.
So 5 is setting the stage in a lot of ways for 6. So if you have Article 5 here setting up, this is the right way to view Law and Gospel, you're going to have in Article 6 coming up with dealing with another controversy, which remains a controversy to this day. Now, what about this thing we call the third use of the law?
Yep, so, which is number 6.
The formulators are pretty brilliant in the way that this thing is structured. The structure is not unintentional, and I think as you read it, that's important to understand. Before they tackle the big controversy, they spend time setting up the proper scriptural way of viewing a particular thing, and then you can deal with the controversy because you've sort of primed the the pump in a sense.
Yeah.
It's excellent pedagogy.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, so then you get, number 6, like we said, third use of the law, which when you read it is actually pretty much a continuation of the law and just saying, how does this work out in the Christian life? Then we have number 7, the Lord's Supper. Of course, this is a lot of controversy. The crypto-Calvinist, right, is where this one would pop in. That's where...
Well, and 2, the sort of the biggest adversary of this time, of course, Roman Catholic, thing that's still going on, but the Anabaptists, too, are here.
Yeah, we differ with Rome, the Anabaptists, and the Calvinists on this position, right? So there's a lot of things going on here. And in fact, Chemnitz debates with somebody in the Calvinist camp over this as well.
The Colloquy of Montpellier?
Yeah.
That's...
is it with Beza?
Beza.
It is with Beza, isn't it?
There's a new... Maybe put in a little plug.
Yeah, we should.
C.J. Armstrong at Concordia University just translated that whole colloquy, something like 700 pages of Latin into English.
It's a really big book.
Edited by Jeff Mallinson.
Yes.
So, we'll throw that in the show notes as well. So there's that and that. So then we get to number 8, Person of Christ. Of course, this is Chemnitz Bailiwick, as we've talked about before. We did an episode just a month ago on the personal work of Christ, and we talked about that.
So kind of in a lot of ways in reverse here, you're going to get here the proper teaching on the Lord's Supper, right? Very much brought to you from the Holy Scriptures. and then you get the contrary doctrines laid out there. But then you get into this on the person, the person.
That's one of the ones that Rome said, I think. Yeah. We don't have a problem with them on this.
Right.
No, yeah.
Since the beginning.
True
humanity, one person, not two.
Yeah, and Chemnitz, or the form, it's always better to say the formulators here, are setting up.
Yeah.
So the stool, the legs to the stool here on this one, on the article in Christ. So you can defend many good and scriptural doctrines
from here.
From here.
Yeah.
Including the sacrament.
Yeah. So that's Yeah, again, the ordering is pretty great. And then we have number 9, The Descent of Christ into Hell, which this has been just a Christian controversy for a long time.
Yeah. And the difficulty of it is the obvious, the lack of verses.
Yeah, there's one, right?
One in 1 Peter, but in a strange one maybe in Ephesians, but it isn't as if you're buried in verses, you're not.
No. Yeah. This is one of the places where you'll see a direct reference to Dr. Luther in the formula too. There are several of those. So some people say, well, Luther's not in the formula. He's referred to quite a bit. His works are referred to several times. He himself is, and this is one of those places. He preached a sermon on Christ's descent into hell, and it's referred in 1533.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and this is something that would be considered creedal Catholic Christianity, right?
Yeah.
That's been...
Yeah, but it was a controversy.
Yeah. Number 10 on church rights, so what we might say traditions, right?
Yeah.
And how the conscience must not be bound by these because they've been done for so long.
Which pops its head up in our modern context in many different ways, right? Especially concerning worship styles. We call adiaphora.
Perhaps more has a seat at home more for them, because these were many people who would remember coming out of the interims and the small Caldic War, where people were forced to practice certain rites and or face the sword and or face exile and or face imprisonment. And so they write this article on church rites and things adiaphora and quote-unquote force, you know, forced participation in things that are neither commanded nor forbidden in scriptures from the perspective of it either having lived through or having a memory of people being forced to worship in a particular way and or face serious punishment.
Yeah, we're not talking like, do I have to sit in a pew that has a guitar or an organ in the morning?
We're not talking, my beloved 10:30 service has turned to guitars. Oh my, I must go to 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
We're not talking about that. We're talking about something else.
Number 11, we get back to election, which again kind of has borders with the beginning of this thing with the free will. And so again, back to the bondage of the will with election. And there's the last one. So, and this is it's a conglomeration. Thank you. Of different heresies and errors in the end, right?
Yeah, but important sort of historical point here, which were not addressed by the Augsburg Confession. Yep. One of the reasons for the necessity of the Formula of Concord was the fact that the Augsburg Confession did not deal with all of these issues, or did not deal with it in great detail, that had sort of put up their head as major controversies from the time of the writing of the Augustana until now. Mm-hmm. And so since the formula doesn't deal with all of them either, you get in Article 12, you sort of get like...
everything else.
A hodgepodge, catch-all. Okay, we know these things are going on too, and they weren't addressed by the Augustana. We didn't really dedicate an article to them either.
Because they pop up after the Augustana, right? Like Anabaptists, you know, that's...
In a way. I mean, Anabaptists are addressed a bit there, but yeah.
Things that can't be tolerated in government.
Yeah.
And that's probably has to do with the switch in government, right, that's happening during the time period because of the political upheaval that the Reformation is causing.
There's been a lot of politics from the point of 1530, 31 till now. I mean, including the Small Caldic War, including the Peace of Augsburg. I mean, there's been a lot of things going on.
They have in here New Arians, anti-Trinitarians.
The New Arians are sort of like the new atheists for us.
Yeah. So it's a pretty comprehensive document, and it's two parts, right? So it's the epitome, which is basically the...
Epitome.
And it's...
the readable version.
That's right. Yeah.
The Reader's Digest version, because it was criticized from the very beginning...
For being too long.
For being too long.
And then you get the full-size version after that.
Yep.
Which is a good place for us.
The Reader's version.
That's a good place for us to take our break. We'll come back and we'll discuss this a little further. We'll talk about who... we've talked about the formulators. I've said the name Chemnitz a couple times. But we'll give people some more credit, name them more names, and then we'll finish out this episode. Mm-hmm. Hey there, and welcome to our break. We're going to talk about another podcast/radio show that is produced by 1517, and that is the You Are Forgiven radio show. The You Are Forgiven radio show plays now in two locations in Southern California. So it's on KKLA, which is the big Christian radio station in the greater Los Angeles area. Pretty sure it reaches Orange County, maybe the most northern parts of San Diego, and into the Inland Empire if you're in California. And then we're also now that has launched in San Diego proper, right? Which means that you can now get it on, I don't know what the name of the radio station in San Diego is. The acronym for the radio station in San Diego is eluding me, but I'll figure it out, and it will also be in the show notes so that you can see it there. But so now you can hear it in San Diego, LA, Orange County, and most, if not all of the Inland Empire, I believe, gets that radio station. Heck, I get KKLA all the way up in Big Bear, so if you're at the right part of the mountain. So this is reaching pretty far on terrestrial radio. But for those of you who are not in Southern California, you can still enjoy this program.
It's K-Praise AM 1210, the Christian station.
Okay, so I would have never remembered that. So K-Praise AM 1210 for those of you in the San Diego area. And I would imagine like Escondido and places like that too. So you can listen to it on live radio.
We probably should characterize it too.
Oh, yeah, I will.
It's an attempted answer to, all right, what does great preaching sound like?
Yeah.
Yeah. And great preaching for those people that would never don the door of a church, and hopefully this will be a gateway if they come to know the gospel of Christ Jesus to them actually becoming, you know, participating members in those churches.
Yeah, which we've seen some stories of. So there's four participating pastors that we have here where their sermons are collected and edited to be the length for the radio program. And then they go on live radio, and their phone numbers and their congregation addresses and things like that are available on the website. So if somebody hears this preaching and wants to know more or needs to talk to somebody, that's been available, and we've had stories of that. Particular Pastor Killian, right, has had several people, even some pre-suicidal people call him and say that his preaching of the gospel stopped them from going through with their plans, and he's worked with some people to get them in local churches and things like that through this radio program. So it's been actually just a fantastic part of 1517's ministry and part of our evangelism that we try to do here. And for those of you not in Southern California, you can get these via your favorite podcasting app. So you look up You Are Forgiven, and it should show up. For me, maybe it's because I've searched it a couple times. It's pretty much the first podcast that shows up if you type in You Are Forgiven Radio. And you can get it in all your favorite podcasting apps, on iTunes, on the Google Play Store, on Overcast, on Stitcher, on Podcast Addict. And I think the best way to describe it is putting kind of that doctrine that we try to teach on the show into actual practice in churches. You know, the difference we've talked about between systematic theology and pastoral theology. And this is true pastoral preaching, preaching the gospel to people. So please go check that show out. We would really like it to see more listeners over there. I think it's one of the most powerful things that 1517 does.
I was skeptical at first, and the facts have forced me back out of that skepticism. There's a sizable percentage in America who will go find good preaching if you tell them where to find it.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's called You Are Forgiven Radio. YouAreForgiven.net is the website where you can find that. And again, you can always subscribe via your favorite podcasting apps. And I believe the trick with all those sermons, because they are radio ready, is that they're all under 20 minutes as well.
Yeah, the whole show, I think, has to be 25 minutes or something like that. And so it's got scripture reading for the day that relate to the sermon, a little intro, a little outro, scripture reading, sermon.
Yeah. So really nice and compact. I know some of the listeners out there, some of our Calvinist listeners, are used to the 40, 50-minute hour sermons.
Yeah.
These are quite shorter than that. So maybe you'll enjoy a nice, powerful, short
sermon. Sometimes we read the scripture reading slower because the sermons are so short.
All right. Well, that's great. So we're now going to start wrapping up this Formula of Concord stuff. And one of the things I realized at the break is that we jumped into the material of the Formula of Concord without talking about its dates or the basic background information. So,
well, we mentioned that there were certain things where there wasn't peace even within our own camp. And the basic thing underneath it all was, can we hammer this out so that everybody in our environment signs on? Not just those in Saxony, but those also in other major cities. And by George, if your question is, did it work? The answer is, yes, it did at its own time. It out of hostility came harmony within our own ranks.
So, Adam, Scott, what are the years for the Formula Concord? When was this published, in a sense, confessed?
So the Elector of Saxony asked for a group of the best theologians of his time to get together in 1576 and come up with something. And so between the two parts that came about in sort of different ways, between the two parts, you have 1577, 1578 as the authoring of the what we now know as the Formula of Concord, and then its publication, official publication, is in 1580 with the rest of the Book of Concord, which would include the creeds, the Augsburg Confession, the Apology, the two catechisms, small called articles, Power and Primacy of the Pope, and the Formula of Concord, and the Epitome, and the Solid Declaration.
Yep. So we've mentioned maybe one or two of the authors' names, but so, and they're typically referred to as the formulators, right?
Right.
And there's two or three primary formulators who actually end up editing the whole thing before it's published, even after. And, but there's probably, I think the list is somewhere around 15 made, you know, contributors originally before getting edited. And so those three main editors or formulators are who?
Jacob or Jakob Andre would be one. Mm-hmm. Martin Chemnitz would be another. I think if you want to think of sort of a father of the Augsburg Confession, probably Chemnitz comes to mind for me. So Jacob Andre, Martin Chemnitz, and then David Catreus is another big name in there. Especially on the parts of the Formula of Concord, I think that have to do specifically with justification and atonement. You can see a big...
You can kind of see where particular writers might have had more sway on a topic there based on other works that we have for them, right?
Right. And then some names that are not as well known, but maybe known some. One that I think some listeners will know would be Nicholas Selnecker. He contributed, or he's one of the formulators. So, and then a bunch of names I think that most people wouldn't be familiar with.
Yeah, again, it's pretty long list. And like you said, the elector was trying to get as many people as possible to come to agreement. And this is part of coming to peace, coming to concord with one another, yeah. Right? You don't want three people in a room coming and saying, all right, we have concord now. There's three of us agree.
Yeah, well, see, that's what happened before. So the Augsburg Confession itself, you could say, and most people do, is written by Philip Melanchthon, but there was sort of a triumvirate that worked on it, especially as they were traveling to Augsburg for the Diet. But after that, I mean, the Apology, Melanchthon's commissioned to write the Apology. Luther writes the catechisms in response to poor catechetical training of both the youth, adults, and the clergy of his time. It's not a commissioning in the same way, but it's a bit of a commissioning too. There were many catechisms that people said, we got to do something about this in the late 1520s. Small called articles. Luther is really, in a way, commissioned to write those as his last theological will and testament. Mm-hmm. Melanchthon writes the Power and Primacy in the Pope as a response kind of to the small called articles. And so most of our other confessions are one author ordeals. And in many cases, they were commissioned by the elector or someone else to be the one author. You can really see that the need has changed here by the fact that so many people are commissioned to work on this thing that, you know, there's people are brought in from other regions. You know, oftentimes these people are not in complete agreement. And so the working out of what goes into the formula is much more extensive than any of our other confessions.
It's kind of interesting. It's almost like... I mean, in a way, like the synods of the early church, right, that are called together by emperors to figure things out.
Yeah, with a particular emphasis on, in our case, it's the theologians,
yeah.
Right? It's not the...
Not the bishops.
Yeah, not the bishops.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, you kind of see that shift in history and how we had to solve problems that maybe, you know, when you left Rome, you also left the organizational structure, right? And you had to kind of find a, and the confession was our way of filling that, that gap.
Is it worth mentioning that there were places, I mean, lots of people signed on. I think something like 3 or 4 imperial electors. It's a yeah. big deal in Germany. Over 8,000 pastors signed on to it. But there are places that did not. Mm-hmm. Denmark, Sweden.
Yeah, the Scandinavians mm-hmm. didn't sign on. They signed on to the Book of Concord minus the formula.
Yeah. Formula of Concord.
And
yeah.
Queen Elizabeth, if I'm not mistaken, of England, lobbied through English embassies in Germany to work against German pastors and princes and things signing on to it. And yeah. I think because of its hard edge against...
Yeah, well, certainly not the middle way
mm-hmm.
yeah. Yeah. that she opted for.
Yeah. Is this the time we might mention helps?
Yeah, this is we're coming towards the end of the episode, so the book's suggestions is...
One that I tried out in the congregation and which worked was a series of booklets. They're 8.5 by 11 and punched by Tigan at the Mankato Lutheran Seminary or College, Mankato, Minnesota, T-E-I-G-E-N. And I found that people actually read through those because they weren't overwhelming. They touch the major points, not everything in each one. There are separate ones for the catechisms, for the Augsburg Confession, and the Apology. For each one of them, Tigen, T-E-I-G-E-N, and those are worth purchasing. They're inexpensive. I don't know if you can get them through 1517.
You can't. The series title is I Believe.
Yeah,
the series title is I Believe, and then you fill in individual confessions or catechism.
Yeah, it looks like you can get the one on the Formula Concord used on Amazon and probably on A-Books, and if the Mankato College bookstore is still open online,
I
believe
so.
They sell them the new copies as well.
Yeah, those are worth grabbing for a congregational level. And another one that I think is worth considering, I entered the whole thing into my outline program, but I can't do anything with it because of copyright. It's by a fellow by the name of Lange, L-A-N-G-E, E. And he publishes through Northwestern Publishing of the Wells, Wisconsin Synod, and it's called The Book of Concord in Outline Form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do they still publish that thing? And it's worth noting additions here for people. I'm going to get a little nerdy on people here. Mm-hmm. There are several English translations of the Book of Concord available.
Yes, worth mentioning.
The two that we commonly use today would be the Kolb Wanger edition, which if you have it, it's blue. It's 600 some odd pages. It's really thick.
It's got double translations.
It's the definitive scholarly translation.
Yeah, I kind of want to say it's like the NASB of translations into the Book of Concord. It's very word for word. Sometimes it reads a little wooden, but it's definitive. The other one that's commonly read today is it's called the Book of Concord or Reader's Edition, which is an update of a very old translation, the Dao Bente translation. Mm-hmm.
With beautiful color photos.
Yeah, it's great. And basically they went in and modernized the English of a very old translation in there. But the one that previous to the Kolb Wanger edition that was sort of the one that mm-hmm. seminarians and everybody read was by Tappert.
Theodore Tappert.
Theodore Tappert.
The red one, right?
Yeah, yep. The red one. The Lange outline that Rod just recommended is connected to the Tappert edition. So if you're reading the Kolb Wanger edition or the Reader's edition...
Doesn't fit very well.
...and trying to correlate it with this outline book that you got, you might have a hard time. So get the Lange... If you get the Lange outline, I'd recommend picking up a used version of the Tappert edition, too.
That's the red one.
Yeah, it's the red one. You can't have too many Book of Concords. I have probably 12 or 13 on my shelf.
Yeah, I've got a lot.
Well, the one for the prior generation was by, we would say, Jacobs.
Right.
Others might say Yacht.
Two volumes, by the way, in the Jacobs. I love that edition, by the way. The one is the Book of Concord, as we know it, the 1580 Book of Concord, as we know it. The other one is... I want to say, I don't want to steal their title, but it's kind of sources and context, too. So you have, like, editions of the Melanchthon's Variata to the Augsburg Confession. You have some articles leading to particular confessions written. It's great. Another great resource is Kolb, Arendt, and Nestegen, Sources and Context of the... I'm sorry, Kolb, Nestegen, Sources and Context to the Book of Concord. Mm-hmm. Some of the documents that led to the writing of various confessions in the Book of Concord is great. Sorry, Rod. And then I got one more. Kolb, Arendt, Nestegen, the Historical Introduction.
Yeah. What about the Triglata? Is that obsolete?
Well, that's the one that they modified in the Reader's Edition.
Huh. Yeah. So Adam's referring to... I'm going to get...
The Concordia Triglata, and that's... Three languages,
yes.
English, German, and Latin.
Yes.
Yeah, so the English is the Dao Bente translation, not updated. So
it's the one that's on the Book of Concord online. They use the Triglotta to make that one.
The one not the not updated Dao Bente translation, the Latin and German is from the old Bekentenschriften, which is the sort of... critical edition.
Yep.
And then it also, the Triglotta also contains F. Bente's Historical Introduction to the Book of Concord at the front.
That's right. Okay.
It's a really thick, I use it sometimes, and it's, I just used it for a paper, and it's it's really thick.
That was ours when I was at the Springfield Seminary of the LCMS. It was the Triglotta that was our textbook.
Mm. Well, that's great. That's amazing. I really like that.
That is out of print. I saw an updated version available on Amazon. Well, like the old one, and they recently did an update that I saw on Amazon.
I would bet Concordia CPH never puts that out of print. So. That would be my bet. If you can't find it somewhere, go to the cph.org website.
Yeah.
Just type in Triglotta. I'm sure it'll come up. So.
And famous, or not famous. I shouldn't pick that adjective. Really competent professor back then, now certainly in glory, had no degrees from anywhere. He was a complete autodidact.
Oh, this is the guy at Springfield?
Yep. Harry Huth, H-U-T-H. And boy, did he know that book. Mm-hmm. I loved it. There was a space for somebody who had completely mastered a field but didn't have formal degrees. There was wiggle room to say, let's get that guy.
Mm. Yeah. There's a new Bekentenschriften, too. But that's a whole other story.
We're now just nerding out. So as you can tell, there's a lot of resources here. We spent the last 5 minutes basically talking about editions of the Book of Concord.
There's more, too. There's some great teaching resources out there. When I first taught, and I don't remember the name of it, I think we'll remember it, Rod. When I first taught the Augsburg Confession, I used that study series from the guy in Australia. I'll find it and put it in Caleb's show notes because I still have it. It's amazing. For pastors who might listen to the show who might want to teach the Augustana, he basically goes through all 28 articles of the Augustana in outline form and then questions at the end. It's great. I mean, one of the things that we've done really well within Lutheranism is, I think, provide resources to teach our confessional literature.
Uh-huh.
It's just some of it's not as well known as others.
Right.
That Tigan series is great, too.
Oh, yeah. It's the beginner's point.
Yeah.
Yeah. He leaves out what should be left out and keeps in what should be kept in, and it's readable.
That's great. Well, thank you for listening to this show. I hope that you join us next week. The next episode is going to be a questions and answers episode. So we have some new ones from listeners that we're going to try to take some time and address. And besides that, you know, just try to, if you're trying to keep up with the show notes and things like that and the names are running past you, if you listen on a podcasting app, they're all linked within those apps, those show notes on the iTunes podcasting app, on Overcast, Stitcher, and things like that. So, again, one of the best ways to get the show is to subscribe. You'll never miss a resource or an episode. So we'll catch you next time. Bye.